What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Pinnacle Performance Podcast. My name is Connor Harris. Today, I have Zach Dakin on, the author of Movement Over Maxes and the TCU Head Strength and Conditioning Baseball Coach. I'm very excited he's here today because we share a similar background within baseball strength and conditioning, and I think he has a lot of really wonderful things to say about strength and conditioning in general, not even just for baseball, but for overall athletic development. So, Zach, thank you very much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks, Connor. Excited to talk some ideas and talk shop, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. That's what it's all about. So what's a quick background on you for those who might not be familiar with where you are, where you come from?
Sure. Yeah, I actually played football at Missouri State University and started my strength and conditioning career at the University of Washington as an intern. Actually, you know, baseball fans will know this as Tim Linscomb's freshman year. I was an intern during Tim Linscomb's freshman year. He came in at, you know, 130 some pounds, tiny little guy. But I went back to Missouri State as a graduate assistant, then took a job with the Anaheim Angels for 2 years. And that's kind of where baseball started to roll for me. I got hired at TCU in 2008 because I had a background in baseball and football. You know, we're the only Power 5 school in the country, actually, that doesn't have a separate strength and conditioning department in terms of, you know, football is usually separate from Olympic sports. So we're the only school that doesn't have that. And that was a big reason for my hire, was because I came from a baseball and football background. So, yeah, going on 13 years coming up.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, it's good that you come from a diverse range of sports, because it's easy to get pigeonholed into one sport and kind of like work up from there. But do you take anything from your football experience and kind of apply that to how you work with the baseball guys?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And especially early on, I had a lot of out of the box ideas. What typically back then, you know, in the mid 2000s, when I was with the Angels, I think it was 05, 06, 07, somewhere in there, and then took the job here at TCU, all of my ideas were out of the box because I had studied, you know, Soviet bloc methods, Eastern bloc training methods for many, many years prior to actually getting involved with baseball, because I wanted the best athletic development that I could find. I played football. I had hopes of playing beyond college days, and so I, you know, trained myself all the time, used some of these crazy, crazy methods. And when I got into baseball, everything that I did was completely foreign. That's honestly changed a ton in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. Baseball has advanced a huge amount as far as, you know, the physical development goes. And so a lot of my ideas are no longer out there, so to speak. But when I first got into baseball, I was in a way shunned by a lot of coaches and strength coaches, because they didn't believe in what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's so valuable, because I think we need people like that if we're going to make progress in the field and within like a specific sector of strength and conditioning. We got to have people that are trying new things and kind of like questioning the status quo and like pushing that envelope a little bit. So like, what's an example of something that you did that was perhaps seen as foreign or unwelcome to some people?
I mean, you name it. It was unwelcome. At the time in professional baseball, there were workouts. I'm not gonna put organizations on blast or anything, but there were workouts that would be one set of 15 to 20 on 15 different hammer strength or Cybex plate loaded machines. I would walk in weight rooms in Arizona, and they wouldn't even have a rack. They wouldn't have a barbell. Dumbbells up to 75 pounds, and that was it. So I can remember at our facility, we did have one rack and we had one barbell, and I used to squat. You know, I came from a football background, so I would clean, I would squat, I would deadlift, I would bench press, and players would be coming through all the time like, man, what are you doing? That's not baseball stuff. That's not baseball stuff. And I'm like, it's squatting, you know. Yeah. Coaches would talk to me all the time about, you know, that's not how baseball teams lift. That's football stuff. So even the basics, like just a barbell deadlift, a barbell squat, were honestly, I was laughed at for doing that in the facility, because that was not baseball stuff.
That's amazing. That's it's I think it's good to be grounded in, you know, what's worked in the past, like quote unquote, but also there's something that's not very, not very good about the idea of this is the way things have always been. Therefore, this is the way things should be. You kind of see that a lot, but yeah, you've got to have like people like you that are doing these things, and you're never going to know unless you try. And if you're doing it safely and responsibly, then I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. So that's awesome, man. So I'm just curious, what are some things that you think are common, for lack of a better term, errors or mistakes you see in general baseball strength and conditioning? Like, what are some things you see commonly throughout the industry that you think that are myths or things that could be easily addressed or fixed by a lot of programs?
Yeah, you know, a couple of the things that I see. One of the big mistakes I think that gets made at the high school level, well, I talk about it a lot in movement over maxes. One is adding too much weight to the bar before a kid knows how to move correctly, right? I hound on that all the time, so I'm not gonna jump on that rant right now. But one of the other big things we see is the lack of posterior work with high school athletes. Everybody wants the bench press, you know, crunches, biceps. They what we call a mirror mentality, that's what they want to train. They want to train the stuff that they see in the mirror. And a lot of times it's the same with coaches, right? A lot of coaches have come from football backgrounds where back in the, you know, back 20 or 30 years ago, bench press, incline press, dumbbell flies, dumbbell bench press, everything was trained. That's how you trained. And so we still see that a little bit today in the fact that, to me, the hamstrings, the glutes, the scapular stabilizers are very, very undertrained in incoming athletes. We see that across the board, whether it's football, whether it's baseball. I'll give you an example. I had a stud of an athlete, a JUCO kid, come in a couple years ago in a recruiting class, put him through the foundation program. You know, the first week that he was in our program, I watched him bust out 30 hand pickup push-ups with no problem. We got him on a barbell to do a reverse pull-up, you know, a horizontal row, basically body weight loaded. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't do 5 correct reps with just a 1-count pause, right? So that's what we see across the board with guys coming in. Some of the other stuff that we see, we continually see coaches want to program speed on off days, so to speak. The weight room becomes their big priority.
Yeah.
And then they come to me and say, hey, you know, we do speed on our off days. How should we handle, you know, such and such? And that's one of the things that I'm working on right now is kind of creating a platform to educate coaches on how to organize workouts better. Mm-hmm. Because to me, speed is a priority for us. We want to train to be faster, more powerful, stronger all the time. But speed is always the priority in that order. It's always the first thing that we do with our athletes on a daily training session. It's speed. It's, you know, the demand for the nervous system is very high. And so we're going to train that first and foremost. And that's the only thing that you use on a field. You don't squat on a field. You're not squatting a barbell. You're not doing a bench press. You're not doing, you know, whatever lift you can think of. You don't do that on the field, but guess what? You sprint, you run, you need speed. So that to me should always be a priority and never put on the back burner, so to speak. Those are two big things that I see right now that you know, I see with coaches and athletes alike that we're trying to correct, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to see the influence that powerlifting and bodybuilding has on all of strength and conditioning. It's relatively new, like the whole field in of itself. And it's amazing to see the flies, the bench presses, and how, like, yeah, that stuff's great, but a lot of people don't know any different because you just don't know what you don't know. And when you resort to things that you see on the internet, it's powerlifting, it's bodybuilding, because, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, that was really, really big. So I think that is hopefully starting to turn around a little bit more. And I think that goes along really well with your first point. And in terms of the scapula stuff, I think this is leading me into my second question really well. I think something that's really important within baseball players is the relationship between the pelvis and the rib cage and the dissociation, but also in terms of like the rib cage and scapular stability, because something that goes so overlooked a lot of the times is that the scapula's got to sit on the rib cage. Like, we can do scap work all day long, but the scap has to be able to sit on the rib cage. And until that isn't established first, then we're not really getting as nearly as much as we could, because you've got to have that smooth gliding of that concave scapula on that convex rib cage, which is why I like to talk about all the time. But it's for so long that went overlooked. So in your opinion, how do you address pelvic and rib cage biomechanics within your program? How do you maximize these things?
Sure. Yeah. To be honest, the pelvis is the first thing that we actually address in our foundation program. I didn't put it in movement over maxes, because at the time I kind of thought that that would go over the heads of a lot of high school coaches and you know, small college coaches that probably don't know, they don't know what I'm talking about in a way. And maybe I should have made it real simplified, but we didn't put that in there. The first thing we do in the foundation program after the warm-up the first day is we start teaching our athletes pelvic motor control. So it's an anterior posterior tilt, right? The reason that the pelvis is such a big foundation principle for us with those athletes is because of the pars fractures issues that we see in Southern States baseball players. And I have to say Southern States, because a lot of the, you know, the Northern States, I talk to coaches up there all the time that really don't know what I'm talking about. So the pars fractures get, you know, baseball kids get them from overextension and rotation, right? They can't control their core. They can't control their pelvis. They're playing year round. So it's stress on them all the time. And that stress eventually breaks down your vertebrae, and we get a stress fracture. So if an athlete doesn't know how to control the pelvis, doesn't know how to control extension and rib flare, then we're going to run into that problem over and over and over. So the pelvis is the foundation piece for us starting out in that foundation program. Like I said, I'm going to take you through our progression real quick. We go from anterior to posterior tilt, and that's motor control. It's just teaching athletes how to move their pelvis, right? Dump the water out the front.
Yep.
Now hold the water in. Don't let it spill, or try to dump it out the back a little bit. And we take them through those progressions. After that, we progress them to rotation, right? Teaching them how to rotate side to side. From there, after we progress through those motor patterns.
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. After we take them through those motor patterns, all right, we progress into our single leg work, which is our hip airplane series. So it goes from, we've got a kneeling hip shift progression that I've posted on Instagram before, into a bird dog hip airplane, into a standing single leg hip airplane. And then from there, we can actually start to add strength to the pattern with, we use the What's That Strap quite a bit. So we can add strength to some of our rotational pelvic patterns. So it's all built around motor control. That's the word I was looking for. It's all built around motor control first, all right? Controlling that, and then moving on to building strength in those patterns. But for me, I mean, it's we could get into some real deep stuff as far as the kinetic chain's concerned. For me, it starts at the pelvis, and once we have that foundation set, everything is built around the pelvis. Once that foundation with the pelvis is set, it works its way up to the lumbar spine. If the pelvis is sloppy, we're going to have problems in the lumbar spine, yes. Right? Which we've already talked about, the spondees, the pars fractures. And it works its way up to the ribs. If we've got huge extension moments through the lumbar spine, we're going to have a big rib flare. A big rib flare leads to a scap that doesn't sit on the cage correctly. Mm-hmm. And then we run into problems at the shoulder. So everything leads to the next piece, right? That kinetic chain is so important. I mean, we could talk about that a lot, actually, if you want to get into it a little bit.
I would love to. I think what you hit is so important, because especially going after the control of flexion and extension first. Because if you think about what's going on within just like a pitch, there are so many biomechanical things going on within that movement. There's abduction, there's adduction, there's internal, external rotation. So many things are going on within just the pelvis itself. And if you don't have simple control of flexion and extension, when you add in the frontal and transverse planes, you're adding on additional, more complicated joint actions that occur, and they cannot occur without a degree of flexion and extension. So we better have good control of that before we move on to abduction, adduction, transverse plane, internal, external rotation. That stuff's got to stick first. So I'm so happy to hear that you go after that motor control and that sense first. But yeah, let's dig into the rib cage now. So in terms of scapular stability, do you have a similar type of progression you use for that?
So the rib cage stuff is really built around teaching our guys how to breathe correctly, right? Mm-hmm. It's tough with 47 guys to get real deep into some PRI principles. I've taken some of the courses. We use them kind of in a one-on-one setting a lot of times with some of our rehab guys. But the first thing that we teach all of our guys, to be honest, in that foundation program after on our recovery days, I should say, the first thing that we teach is diaphragmatic breathing, teaching our guys how to move their ribs correctly, how to breathe correctly so that we can put them back in a parasympathetic state. So that is another one of those principles that we're heavily after on recovery days with mm-hmm. our foundation program. But the rib cage, you know, it dictates all. Like I said, it starts at the pelvis, works its way up the rib cage. You know, I've talked about a study before by Strunz in 2009, where they looked at, you know, if you need any clarification on how the shoulder is affected by the rib cage, they detailed that rib manipulations, thoracic spine manipulations, with their patients, and these were non-athletic patients, I believe, but they tested and retested. They had the general population was gaining 30 some degrees in shoulder flexion just because of rib manipulations and thoracic spine manipulations. So that shows you in that study alone how important or the effect that the ribs have on the shoulder joint, which, you know, is really two joints away. Mm-hmm. Edmonston in 2012 is another study that I've talked about before, looked at the thoracic spine and how much involvement the thoracic spine had in overhead flexion. They studied it, I think, through an ultrasound or something and actually measured thoracic extension. But again, it goes back. The thoracic spine is dependent on the rib cage, and the rib cage mm-hmm. is dependent on the lumbar spine and the pelvis. So if we don't have the foundation set down below, then everything up the chain is going to be thrown off.
Yeah. And isn't it so funny how in the past, we've always been so big about thoracic extension, like more thoracic extension, more. And there's nothing wrong with thoracic extension. But if we're stuck in thoracic extension, then we have a problem because we can't get air back there in the posterior rib cage. Because if you look at a normal human spinal curve, there's a little bit of flexion in the thoracic spine because that's where that scapula needs to sit. So yeah, the diaphragmatic breathing, usually if you clear that up, you're going to clear up a lot of scapular and shoulder stuff, just like you said. And those articles are awesome. I was not aware of that first one you said, so I'm going to have to check that out.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. you go.
I might have lost my train of thought with that, but the rib cage can't be. It's so vitally important. You know, I didn't touch on some of our progressions that we throw in as far as thoracic rotation flexion go. We screen all of our guys. We put them, you know, through kind of a modified FMS, and then I take them through another SFMA. On top of that, we look at. We look at how the scapula moves. We take video, how the scapula moves in flexion, how it moves into abduction, how they return from those positions. Then we'll actually turn them to the side and we'll get a view of protraction. We'll look at thoracic curve a little bit and we'll see, you know, we'll actually see and evaluate what those guys look like if they have a thoracic curve or if it's completely flat, if they're getting flexion, you know, further down in the spine. So we evaluate those, and then we can kind of build an individualized program with some of our on our recovery days based mm-hmm. on what the athlete actually needs. So,
gotcha. What tool do you use for that?
I'm sorry, what's that?
What tool do you use to analyze those things?
Eyeballs.
Eyeballs. Okay, that works. That's pretty complicated,
when you say what tool? Are you talking about, are we measuring goniometer wise?
Like, are you using some sort of like technology or are you just using the traditional? Okay.
No. So I video everything on those screens. So they've got actually a three-step screening process. So It gets more detailed, but everything I do is video based, so I can go back and actually look at it, analyze it. And then they'll meet with our physical therapist, which is a team that will do more goniometer work. I do internal external rotation at the hip and the shoulder as far as the goniometer goes. And then they'll go meet with our physical therapist. They'll go through another round of screening. And then they'll finally meet with our orthopedic therapist or orthopedic surgeon therapist. Our orthopedic surgeon, and he'll do his own exam on them to finish. And by the time they've gone through those three processes, we should have a good idea of what everybody's dealing with. That screening process really sets us up so that we can learn about the athlete a little bit and figure out if there's something that we didn't know that happened in high school. It opens up the line of communication so that we can find problems that we didn't know exist.
Gotcha. For the high school strength coaches out there, what do you think is the biggest deficiency in terms of, I don't know, you can go anywhere with it, in terms of strength, in terms of range of motion, in terms of mechanics of the scapula and pelvis? Like, what do you see as a very common theme with incoming freshmen?
Oh, boy. To me, and I like I said, I don't want to hound on this too much, but with young athletes, if you will just teach them how to move correctly, you will clear up the majority of your problems. Because young kids, the younger you get, the less mobility a kid needs, right? Because they're loose as a goose. They actually need strength as high school kids. They need to be able to build strength, the foundation of strength, but on top of movement, so that they can start to build all those other biomotor abilities. Because strength, power, speed, power, those are all built on a foundation of strength eventually. But if you don't have the foundation to move correctly, we're just going to create compensations and breakdowns later on. So really, it has to start with movement. Teach the kids how to move correctly first, and then we can build some strength on top of that, because nothing happens without correct movement. And when you start to build those two processes, movement and then strength, you're going to correct a lot of those movement deficiencies that we see with young kids, junior high and high school kids. If you're doing pulling patterns, you're going to correct a lot of the scapular dysfunction and problems that you see with movement, right? It's at the higher levels that you have to get kind of more detailed and more like microscopic in a way to break down some of those compensation patterns that these kids have had for 6, 7, 8 years, right?
Yeah. You got to undo them before you can actually get what you want out of them. Yeah.
Right.
I hear that time and time again on the college level. I think like earning the ability to use a barbell or weight or an external load is an important thing, because it's easy to want to throw kids into the fire in high school and kind of just, have them bulk up, so to speak. But I think the biggest performance benefits from strength and conditioning on a high school level, unless we're talking like really high level kids here, is just getting them to get that motor control and the basic patterns. Like that alone, even with light loads, in my experience, is going to be so much more profound in terms of what you see on the field than getting that kid to back squat 225 for reps with just shitty form. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So kind of transitioning here, I'm curious, something we were big on in Oregon State with the baseball program was grip strength and how it relates to elbow and shoulder health. Do you do anything for grip strength? Because what we would do is we would have them come in once a week, and I forget what the tool is, but you squeeze it as hard as you can, get a reading, and that would also give you some other indications as to maybe how this athlete is recovering or, how they're feeling that day. There's oftentimes correlations.
Yeah. So yeah, you're talking about the old hand dynamometer.
Yeah.
We've used it before. I've used it in the past to try to determine readiness. We've actually struggled to find a correlation with readiness and hand grip strength. Mm. I know there's studies out there. The Soviets talked about it at various points. But honestly, in our own training, we really haven't found a big correlation right now between fatigue and hand grip strength yet. We might need more data. I've used it several years. I mean, I used it, when I first got the TCU, probably 11 or 12 years ago, to try to correlate some of that fatigue back to hand grip strength. And then I started using it again this past year. And so far the data just, it hasn't been clear, if you want my honest opinion.
That's good for people to hear. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as the readiness testing stuff, one of the best things you can do and this goes for high school coaches especially, is just ask your players how they feel, right? If you know your players, you can see, a coach can see immediately when players aren't talkative, when they're, you know, when they look sleepy. You can see immediately when a kid looks like he's down a little bit, mm-hmm. right? So we created a super, super easy system. I mean, we've had apps and such in the past. And yes, we might go back to those where the kids fill out how they feel, how many hours of sleep, you know, and it's 10 questions. And then before you know it, you've added two more questions and asked 12 questions. We made it simple this year. Everything I do in season is based around options. So the kids always have options as far as intensity and volume go. All right. If we're talking about readiness testing, so they always have options to their workout. When they walk in the weight room, we actually track on a sheet, and we came up with a scale this year because it was just easier for us. I asked them how they felt, and if they felt alive and well, you felt great, you were free to go about your workout as planned. All right. If you wanted to add some volume and intensity, have at it. If you want to work up to a heavy single or whatever the case is, alive and well. The second answer would be just alive, right? So basically, you know, just run of the mill day for you. You know, I don't feel great. I don't feel bad. Got enough sleep. I'm doing fine. Okay. Workout as planned, right? And then dead was our third rating. So you were alive and well, you were just alive, or you were dead, mm-hmm. right? And if you were dead, you got to use lower intensity parameters. You might do two sets on every exercise and then you're out of the weight room quick. Mm-hmm. So to be honest, we get so inundated sometimes with technology and how much, and you know, how much can we track and how much can we give to these kids to fill out and do and all this other stuff. It was simple for us to just use those three ratings and then use our eyeballs to see how the kids felt, right? Because you can always see in a warm-up. You can see how a kid moves immediately and say, man, this kid doesn't look right today. He looks tired. He looks fatigued. How you feel? Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't? Oh, okay, well, there you go. You know, take some volume off the workout. I'm going to make you do the light sets as far as percentages go. And, you know, we'll do the lowest volume accessory exercises or whatever. So we give them options in season. Right? We made it very, very simple. I've always used options in season, but we made it very, very simple with that three system ratings we had.
I like how you have three options too, because it's easy to make it like a scale of 1 to 5 or 1 to 10. And then it's like, great. So you're a 6 as opposed to a 7. What does that mean? Like it's not very useful, but like a 1, 2, 3, that's plug and play. That's like, you're good to go. So that's really great. And I think, well, one question I wanted to ask is, so let's say they come in and they're a 1, do they know specifically how much volume they need to adjust that day?
Yeah. So it's always, their sheet is always listed out, and before the workout starts, we talk about that. So, you know, I'll bring the group in and I'll say, all right, you know, if you feel dead today, you guys are going to handle the light intensity. So on their workout mm-hmm. card, actually, I'll have the regular intensities and a light intensity chart over on the other side, which is usually a 15% drop. Mm-hmm. So if we're at, you know, at 80% for the day, the light percentages are going to be 65%. There's going to be decreased volume on those light percentages. And then they'll know, we always have optional sets and highlighted sets in the accessory work. So they know if I'm dead, I do none of the highlighted sets. I have to work on the light option over here and I have to work on the low volume chart. So all the kids kind of know it's just that simple. Mm-hmm. The workout set up, I tell them, you know, if you feel dead, this is how you're handling it. If you feel good, workout is regular. If you feel great and you want to work up a little bit heavier, let me know. We'll see how your reps look and then we'll make a determination based on that.
Sweet. How many days a week do you guys usually train in season?
So in season, our guys will train 3 days a week. It's usually two total body days with an upper and lower emphasis. And then the third day is a more kind of like an activation recovery based day. Mm-hmm. A lot of times that's kind of a game day lift for us. Our relievers, obviously your starting pitcher is built around his own schedule, mm-hmm. right? So they're built around their throwing schedule. Relievers for us, we usually train Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Like I said, that Friday morning is an activation, sort of a recovery type day. And then we break it down based on playing time, based on training age. With our position players, we've got a tier 1, a tier 2, and a tier 3. group. So our tier one are our starters. Those guys will lift 2 times a week, like we detailed, with that third day as an option. Our tier two guys are bench contributors. So those guys are, they might be younger guys that, you know, have a spot defensive. They play some defense spotty on the weekends here and there. They might have a, you know, a Tuesday. They might play during a Tuesday game or something like that. You've got your DHs, that type of guy.
Yeah.
Those are our tier two guys, usually younger training age. Those guys will train 3 days a week. So they'll train Monday, Wednesday, Friday, total body. And then we've got our tier three guys, which are developmental, usually freshmen that aren't playing at all, might be a red shirt, something like that. Those guys will train 3 to maybe 5 times per week.
Gotcha. And so something I saw you tweeted out recently was that in season, the whole periodization thing, and you see a lot of great coaches talk about this. It's just, you know, it's hard to do. It's not very feasible because the schedule always gets messed up. And if you miss one day in a periodization, you know, program, it can really throw off the rest of your program. So something that I've subscribed to myself as well is, you know, everything being present within a program, just that varying volumes and intensities depending on what adaptation you're going for. So when you're in season, can you just walk us through the thought process of like, what am I trying to get? Like, because obviously you want to maintain certain qualities to a certain extent, but
it's
also good to, you know, keep the kids focused on, hey, let's still get better in certain areas. So what are you kind of trying to do there?
Yeah, so I'll just lay out the principles for our in-season training, because that's something I've been studying, and I've been studying periodization for the last 10 days, like you can't imagine. So my mind is spinning around some of the stuff. But the principles for us on our in-season training, number one, come down to consistency. Our guys are stronger in-season because we are consistent with our training. Again, that goes back to the high school issue that we see so many kids don't train in-season during their high school season, which is absolutely ludicrous to me, because the only reason you're training to be a better baseball player is so that for the in-season, so that you're strong, athletic, fast during the in-season period. And as a high school athlete, you're going to lose those gains quickly. So a kid that stops training in December or January preparing for the in-season, those gains, well, you won't maintain those gains for more than a couple of weeks at most. Yeah. So number one, it's built around consistency. We have consistent schedules. And our head coach is awesome in that we never deviate from those schedules. Like I said, our kids are stronger in season than they are in the off season, because the off season is loaded. You know, you got Thanksgiving, you've got finals weeks where we can't train. You've got a fall break in there. In the middle of that semester, we have fall ball. So we've got a lot of like stoppages of training and missed training and downtime. So the in-season is by far the best development that we get throughout the entire year. Mm. The second principle that I talk about a lot is variety. People want to change workouts all the time, change exercises, you know, change. For us, we don't want a bunch of variation in season. And the reason that we don't is because as soon as you add a new stimulus to the body, to an athlete, What are they gonna get? They're gonna get sore. They're gonna get stiff, right? A new stimulus is gonna create adaptation problems right away with athletes. So we don't change our stimulus hardly at all in season. I essentially have 2 blocks that we run. We run an A block and a B block, and there's exercises associated with each. But we rotate back and forth between those blocks so that we're not introducing, you know, random stuff 6 weeks into the season, and then more random stuff at week 10 and 14 and 18 or however you handle your program. Mm. There's lack of variation, to be honest, in season. We vary tempos, we vary reps, sets, intensities, but we don't vary movements.
I see. So then what would be your strategy for the recovery days? That third recovery day, like what are you trying to do to maximize recovery? What have you found works? What have you found doesn't work as well?
Well, you know, while we're on the topic of recovery, I'll say this real quick. We prefer like starting pitchers. This is a huge question. You know, starting pitchers, do you want to do stuff as soon as you come out of the game? Do you want to wait until the next day? Our view on recovery, specifically recovery, is we want it to happen the next day always. I'm not a guy that likes doing a bunch of stuff after a guy comes out of a game. You know, you know, we use the analogy, like, you just, if a guy went out and ran a marathon or a half marathon, he doesn't cross the finish line and say, I'm going to go run lighter so that I can recover from this, right? We stop. So a starting pitcher that comes out of the game, a starter will oftentimes throw over 200 balls in a day. And that's where people don't, you know, they don't often realize how much throwing a starting pitcher does on a start. We had the Moto sleeve for the last 2 years and we've used it and found that we've had starting pitchers that have thrown over 280 balls on a day when they started, right? When you start talking about your warm-up, plyo work, long toss, bullpen stuff, your warm-up pitches in between innings, once you actually are in the game, that's a lot of volume. So there's a ton of throwing. So we save everything recovery-wise for the next day. The Soviets have done studies on this. If you introduce recovery-type means immediately after, you know, finishing hard workouts, it often delays the compensation, super compensation effect. It actually hurts you the next day, and your body's actually depressed. You have worse work capacity numbers than if you waited 12 hours and did that recovery, you know, just finish the workout, get back to a parasympathetic state as fast as you can, which we can do some breathing and things to do that, and then do your recovery the next day. And that's when we see work capacity numbers go up. So, you know, I got off topic there, but that's a huge question. Everybody,
that was awesome.
Everybody wants to talk about starting pitchers and recovery. I'm not going to take a guy that threw 250 balls in a game and come out and do a bunch more eccentric work for his rotator cuff and his scap. You know, you're just wearing down, you're wearing down something that's already been worn down.
Yeah. And that's something you really opened up my eyes to. And that definitely, when you wrote something about it not too long ago, and it really changed my opinion because it makes sense. And what we want to implement the recovery stuff right away because it's out of good intentions and it comes out of a good place, but it's, you know, you're just adding more stress. If, like, we think of recovery as, you know, if recovery is a bucket and, you know, it's, you got liquid in the bucket, when it overflows, then you have recovery problems. We think of taking liquid out of that bucket, but you're just pouring more in a lot of the times. So
I was going to use the exact same analogy, the cup. I was going to use the cup of water, right? You've only got so much that you can fit in the cup. And everything is stress. Everything is stress. Even recovery. Yeah. This is what people don't understand, is that recovery is stress too. When you go get in a hot tub and you've got, you know, your body's getting extremely overheated like that in a hot tub, your body's under stress, right?
Yeah.
It's trying to maintain homeostasis. So everything is stress. It doesn't matter recovery, workout. When your heart rate goes up, it's stress.
Yeah.
So it all factors in.
Yeah. Everything the brain is trying to do is just find homeostasis, all these processes, which, and honestly, man, like the whole recovery thing, I think just having fun and relaxing and like just promoting an exceptionally appealing environment to that individual, I think that goes way further for people's recovery than, you know, getting a foam roller, you know, getting a Theragun and digging deep. Like, you know, what's going to promote recovery the best? You know, a parasympathetic state. What's a parasympathetic state? It's a non-threatening state. What's a non-threatening state? It's having fun with your friends. It's having fun, just relaxing and having a good time, appealing to the senses. I think that's so important. So on these recovery days, like, what are some strategies you're using?
So, yeah. So, you know, you asked about the Friday recovery day on a game day recovery or activation day for our pitchers. That might be something we do, is we integrate like speed ladders, right? I am not a speed ladder guy. I understand the drawbacks and I understand the speed ladder just fine, but we use it on game days because our kids love it. We put them in races. They compete in different patterns. The kids have a ton of fun with it, but it's also like, it's stimulating for them. So it's kind of an activation where it's a lot of fast movement, right? And you have to think through it a little bit. So it's kind of a stimulation for the nervous system as well. But those recovery days are really built around, we do some speed ladder work to warm up. That's our warm up, 10 or 15 minutes of fun. We go in, we'll do our soft tissue work. We'll work on sticky areas. We'll do a lot of movement, just general mobility movement type work. We'll do some activation, rotator cuff, some pelvic and some type of core activation. And then we'll get back to a parasympathetic state by doing several breathing exercises. We'll do some lat, you know, some lat, what do I call it? I call it a lat strap stretch breathing. It's like the squatted, you're holding onto straps out in front of you. Guys are squatted down all the way, right? Trying to breathe into the backside a little bit. We'll go through our lat strap stretch breathing routine. We'll go some box breathing a lot of times, but anything to get them back into a parasympathetic state before they walk out. And honestly, those recovery activation days are really just to get those guys up, stay on schedule, keep them moving around a little bit, get a little bit of, a little bit of work in and get them out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's huge. Just like the keeping the routine of, hey, you're coming in, you're doing something that keeps them focused on tasks. That's great stuff. Just to wrap up here, because I got to dip out for a webinar soon. I just would like to end with a funny story. Anything. It could be anything. Strength and conditioning related, weight room, on the field, game day stuff. Anything you want.
I've got stories for days. I do have – this is a funny story, and I don't recommend this to the kids out there, right? But my first year at TCU – the culture wasn't quite created yet. So that was, something that obviously we had a big focus on. We had a team that liked to party a lot, right, at the time. So I had a pitcher come in at this time. They weren't in groups, so they kind of come in individually. It was my first month, to be honest, at TCU probably. And we didn't have a bunch of equipment. So I was having guys do scapular series, Ys, Ts, external rotation work, prone on a stability ball. So they'd have to lay on the stability ball to do this stuff. And I was watching a kid, and he got about 6 Ys in and then kind of just dozed off and fell asleep on the ball. Kid actually fell asleep on the ball. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And so I kept watching him, and I was like, what the heck is going on with this kid? And then he perked up and did another 2 reps and just kind of drifted down, right? Drifted down asleep. So I watched him for the next couple minutes, and it would kind of go up back and forth, right? He'd realize he fell asleep and perk up. What happened was the kid was super, super hungover, been out drinking, right, and was falling asleep on the physio ball. So eventually I had to go over, wake the kid up, and kick him out of the weight room because you're obviously in no shape to lift. But, so the story is my first year with some of the kids that were doing a little extracurricular activity at night, they run deep.
I imagine. Yeah, I have plenty of stories just like that myself, but that's funny. I've never seen one fall asleep in the weight room. That's impressive.
Yeah, that was a first for me.
All right. Well, thanks, Zach. I appreciate you taking the time. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'd love to have you back on at some point, man.
Yeah. Thanks, Connor. I appreciate it.